Yet in all of this lexicographical sound and fury, seven major dictionaries had been produced in 17th century England, the last having no fewer than 38,000 headwords, two matters were being ignored. The first was the need for a good dictionary to encompass the language in its entirety, the easy and popular words as well as the hard and obscure, the vocabulary of the common man as well as that of the learned house, the aristocrat, and the rarefied school. Everything should be included. The might of a two-letter preposition should have no less standing in an ideal word list than the majesty of a piece of polysyllabic sesquipedalianism. The second matter that dictionary makers were ignoring was the coming recognition elsewhere that with Britain and its influence now beginning to flourish in the world, with daring sailors like Drake and Raleigh and Frobisher skimming the seas, with European rivals bending before the might of British power, and with new colonies securely founded in the Americas and India, which spread the English language and English concepts far beyond the shores of England, English was trembling on the verge of becoming a global language. It was starting to be an important vehicle for the conduct of international commerce, arms, and law. It was displacing French, Spanish, and Italian, and the courtly languages of foreigners. It needed to be far better known, far better able to be properly learned. An inventory needed to be made of what was spoken, what was written, and what was read. The Italians, the French, and the Germans were already well advanced in securing their own linguistic heritage, and had gone so far as to ordain institutions to maintain their languages in fine fettle. In Florence, the Accademia della Crusca had been founded in 1582, dedicated to maintaining Italian culture, even though it had been three centuries before there was a political entity called Italy. But a dictionary of Italian was produced by the Accademia in 1612. The linguistic culture was alive, if not the country. In Paris, Cardinal Richelieu had established the Académie Française in 1634. The 40 Immortals, rendered in perhaps more sinister fashion as simply the 40, have presided over the integrity of the tongue with magnificent inscrutability until this day. But the British had taken no such approach. It was in the 18th century that the impression grew that the nation needed to know in more detail what its language was and what it meant. The English at the close of the 17th century, it was said, were uncomfortably aware of their backwardness in the study of their own tongue. From then on, the air was full of schemes for bettering the English language, for giving it greater prestige both at home and abroad. Dictionaries improved, and very markedly so, during the first half of the new century. The most notable of them, a book that did indeed expand its emphasis from mere hard words to a broad swathe of the entire English vocabulary, was edited by a Stepney boarding school owner named Nathaniel Bailey. Very little's known about him, other than his membership in the Seventh-day Baptist Church. But the breadth of his scholarship, the scope of his interest, is amply indicated by the title page of his first edition. There were said to be 25 editions between 1721 and 1782, all of them bestsellers. This title page also hints at the quite formidable task that lay ahead of any drudge who might be planning to create a truly comprehensive English lexicon. Bailey's work was entitled A Universal Etymological Dictionary, comprehending the derivations of the generality of words in the English tongue, either ancient or modern, from the ancient British, Saxon, Danish, Norman, and modern French, Teutonic, Dutch, Spanish, Italian, Latin, Greek, and Hebrew languages, each in their proper characters. And also, a brief and clear explication of all difficult words, and terms of art relating to botany, anatomy, physic, together with a large collection and explication of words and phrases used in our ancient statutes, charters, writs, old records and processes at law, and the etymology and interpretation of the proper names of men, women, and remarkable places in Great Britain, also the dialects of our different counties, containing many thousand words more than any English dictionary before extant, to which is added a collection of our most common proverbs with their explication and illustration. The whole work, compiled and methodically digested, as well as for the entertainment of the curious, as the information of the ignorant, and for the benefit of young students, artificers, tradesmen, and foreigners. Good the volumes and the effort may have been, but still not quite good enough. Nathaniel Bailey and those who tried to copy him in the first half of the 18th century laboured mightily at their task, though the task of corralling the entire language became ever larger the more it was considered. Yet still no one seemed intellectually capable or brave or dedicated enough, or simply possessed of enough time, to make a truly full record of the entire English language. And that, though no one seemed able even to say so, was what was really wanted. An end to timidity, to pussyfooting, the replacement of the philologically tentative by the lexicographically decisive. And then came the man whom Tobias Smollett called literature's great Cham, one of the most eminent literary figures of all time, Samuel Johnson. He decided to take up the challenge before which so many others had flinched. And even with the critical judgment of the more than two centuries since, it can be fairly said that what he created was an unparalleled triumph. Samuel Johnson's A Dictionary of the English Language was, and has remained ever since, a portrait of the language of the day in all of its majesty, beauty, and marvellous confusion. Few are the books that can offer so much pleasure to look at, to touch, to skim, to read. They can still be found today, often cased in boxes of brown morocco. They're hugely heavy, built for the lectern rather than the hand. They're bound in rich brown leather, the paper is thick and creamy, the print impressed deep into the weave. Few who read the volumes today can fail to be charmed by the quaint elegance of the definitions of which Johnson was a master. Take, for example, the word for which Shakespeare might have hunted, elephant. It was, Johnson declared, the largest of all quadrupeds, of whose sagacity, faithfulness, prudence, and even understanding many surprising relations are given. This animal is not carnivorous, but feeds on hay, herbs, and all sorts of pulse, and is said to be extremely long-lived. It is naturally very gentle, but when enraged, no creature is more terrible. He is supplied with a trunk, or long, hollow cartilage, like a large trumpet, which hangs between his teeth and serves him for hands. By one blow with this trunk, he will kill a camel or a horse, and will raise a prodigious weight with it. His teeth are the ivory so well known in Europe, some of which have been seen as large as a man's thigh and a fathom in length. Wild elephants are taken with the help of a female ready for the male. She's confined to a narrow place round which pits are dug, and these, being covered with a little earth scattered over hurdles, the male elephant easily falls into the snare. In copulation, the female receives the male lying upon her back, and such is his pudicity that he never covers the female so long as anyone appears in sight. Yet Johnson's dictionary represents more, far more, than mere quaintness and charm. Its publication represented a pivotal moment in the history of the English language. The only more significant moment was to commence almost exactly a century later. Samuel Johnson had been thinking about and planning the structure of his dictionary for many years. He'd been doing so in part to create a reputation for himself. He was a schoolteacher turned scribbler, known only in limited metropolitan circles as the parliamentary sketchwriter for the Gentleman's Magazine. He was eager to have himself better regarded. But he began the process also in response to calls from the giants, demands that something needed to be done. Theirs was a near universal complaint. Joseph Addison, Alexander Pope, Daniel Defoe, John Dryden, Jonathan Swift, the leading lights of English literature had each spoken out, calling for the need to fix the language. By that, fixing has been a term of lexicographical jargon ever since, they meant establishing the limits of the language, creating an inventory of its word stock, forging its cosmology, deciding exactly what the language was. Their considered view of the nature of English was splendidly autocratic. The tongue, they insisted, had by the turn of the 17th century become sufficiently refined and pure that it could only remain static or else thenceforward deteriorate. By and large, they agreed with the beliefs of the 40 immortals across the Channel, though they would have been loath to admit it. A national standard language needed to be defined, measured, laid down, chased in silver, and carved in stone. Alterations to it then could be permitted or not, according to the mood of the great and the good, a homegrown 40, a national language authority. Swift was the fiercest advocate of all. He once wrote to the Earl of Oxford to express his outrage that words like bamboozle, uppish, and of all things, couldn't, were appearing in print. He wanted the establishment of strict rules banning such words as offensive to good sense. In future, he wanted all spellings fixed, a firm orthography, the correctness of writing. He wanted the pronunciations laid down, an equally firm orthoepy, the correctness of speech. Rules, rules, rules. They were essential, declared Gulliver's creator. The language should be accorded just the same dignity and respect as those other standards that science was then also defining. What is blue or yellow, physicists were then wondering. How hot is boiling water? How long is a yard? How to define what musicians knew as middle C? What indeed of the precise measurement of longitude so vital to seamen? Enormous efforts were being made in this particular field at just the same time as the debate over the national language. A board of longitude had just been set up by the government, funds were being dispersed, and prizes offered just so that a clock could be invented that would go to sea on a ship and be only almost imperceptibly inaccurate. Longitude was vitally important. So great a trading nation as Britain needed to have its ship's masters know exactly where they were. And so the thinking of great literary men went, if longitude was important, if the defining of colour, length, mass and sound was vital, why was the same import not given to the national tongue? As one pamphleteer wailed appropriately, we have neither grammar nor dictionary, neither chart nor compass to guide us through the wide sea of words. No dictionary had proved adequate so far, said Swift and his friends, but given the heights of perfection that the language had already achieved, one was now needed, and a dedicated genius must be found and applied to the task of making one. It would accomplish two desirable deeds, the fixing of the language and the maintenance of its purity. But Samuel Johnson, however, could not have disagreed more. At least he wanted to have no truck with ordering the language to remain pure. He might have liked it to, but he knew that it couldn't be done. As to whether he thought it possible or desirable to fix it, theses have tumbled by the score from academic presses in recent years, arguing variously that Johnson did want to or that he didn't. The consensus now is that he originally planned to make a fix on the tongue, but when he was halfway through his six-year task, he came to realize that it was both impossible and undesirable. One of his predecessors, Benjamin Martin, explained why. No language, as depending on arbitrary use and custom, can ever be permanently the same, but will always be in a mutable and fluctuating state, and what is deemed polite and elegant in one age may be accounted uncouth and barbarous in another. This dictum, which appeared in the preface to still another half-baked attempt at a proper dictionary, just a year before Johnson brought out his own, might as well have guided the great Cham throughout his entire construction. For all the heady talk among London's intelligentsia, it was actually the free market that prompted Johnson to begin. In 1746, a group of five London booksellers, the famous Messrs. Longman among them, were seized with the idea that a brand new dictionary would sell like hot cakes. They approached their favourite parliamentary writer, whom they knew to be both eager and broke, and made him an offer he could scarcely refuse, 1,500 guineas, half of it up front. Johnson agreed readily, with the sole caveat that he would seek as patron the man who was currently the arbiter of all that was good and worthwhile in literary England, Philip Dormer Stanhope, the 4th Earl of Chesterfield. Lord Chesterfield was one of the most remarkable figures in the land, an ambassador, a Lord Lieutenant of Ireland, a friend of Pope, Swift, Voltaire, and John Gay. It was Chesterfield who had forced England to adopt the Gregorian calendar, and it was Chesterfield whose letters to his bastard son Philip, advising him on his behaviour, became, when published, an indispensable vade mecum of good manners. His imprimatur on the dictionary would be valuable, his patronage of the project invaluable. That he promised the imprimatur, but declined the patronage, except for handing Johnson a draft for a measly £10, but then went on to claim a part in Johnson's subsequent triumph, became a source of well-publicised hard feelings. Lord Chesterfield, Johnson was to say later, taught the morals of a whore and the manners of a dancing master. Chesterfield had the elephantine hide of a true aristocrat, however, and brushed off the criticisms as good-natured, which they were not. His early advocacy of the dictionary, plus the 750 guineas that the booksellers had placed in Johnson's hand, nonetheless set the 37-year-old editor to work. He took rooms off Fleet Street, hired 6 serving men, 5 of them Scotsmen, which would come as some eventual comfort to James Murray, who was from Hoyk, took them as his amanuenses, and settled down to the 6 years of unremitting drudgery that were to prove necessary. He had decided, as Murray was to decide a century later, that the best way, indeed the only way, to compile a full dictionary was to read, to go through all literature and list the words that appeared on hundreds of thousands of pages. It's an axiom that you have 3 overlapping choices in making a word list. You may record words that are heard, you may copy the words from other existing dictionaries, or you may read, after which, in the most painstaking way, you record all the words you have read, sort them, and make them into a list. Johnson dismissed the first idea as far too cumbersome to be useful. He naturally agreed to the second. All lexicographers use earlier dictionaries as a starting point to make sure they miss nothing. And most significantly, he decided on the primary importance of the third choice, reading. Hence the taking of the rooms off Fleet Street, hence the buying or borrowing of books by the ton and the yard and the sack, and hence the hiring of the 6 men. The team, totalling 7, had been created to browse and graze through all existing writings, and to make a catalogue of all that was swept into the team's collective maw. It was swiftly realized that it would be impossible to look through everything, and so Johnson imposed limits. The language, he decided, had probably reached its peak with the writings of Shakespeare, Bacon, and Edmund Spenser, and so there was probably precious little need to go look further back than their lifetimes. He ruled, therefore, that the works of Sir Philip Sidney, who was only 32 when he died in 1586, would usefully mark the starting point for his search, and the last books, published by newly dead authors, would mark the end. His dictionary would thus be the result of a concerted trawl through just a century and a half of writing, with the odd piece of Chaucer thrown in for good measure. So Johnson took down these books and read, then underlined and circled words he wanted, and annotated the pages he had chosen. He then demanded that his men copy onto slips of paper the full sentences that displayed his chosen words, and these he then filed, to use when necessary, to illustrate the point he was making, the meaning of a word that he was trying to show. And it was all those quoted meanings, a demonstration of the multiplicity of subtle shadings of sense that can be encompassed by the simple arrangement of a group of letters, that prove the great triumph of Johnson's dictionary. For while we might laugh at the quaint charm of his definition of elephant, or of oats, a grain which in England is generally given to horses, but in Scotland supports the people, or of lexicographer, a writer of dictionaries, a harmless drudge that busies himself in tracing the original and detailing the signification of words, we can only be staggered by his dealings with, say, the verb take. Johnson listed, with supportive quotations, no fewer than 113 senses of this particular verb's transitive form, and 21 of the intransitive. To seize, grasp, or capture, to catch with a hook, to catch someone in an error, to win popular favour, to be effective, to claim to do something, to assume the right, to mount a horse, to flee, to perform what one does in removing one's clothing. The list is almost endless. It was a mark of Samuel Johnson's genius that, armed with references from 150 years of English writings, he was able, and essentially single-handedly, to find and note almost every use of every word of the day. Not simply take, but other common coin like set and do and go and hundreds upon hundreds of others. Small wonder that once his project was well underway and the trifling business of his creditors' needs arose, he once barred the door to the milkman with his bed, crying from behind the door, "Depend on it, I'll defend this little citadel to the utmost." He finished amassing his list of the English word stock in 1750. He spent the next 4 years editing the citations and choosing the 118,000 illustrative quotations, sometimes by committing the heresy of changing quotes that he didn't like. Finally, he completed the definitions of what were to become the 43,500 chosen headwords. He wrote some of these definitions from scratch, or else he borrowed substantial passages for others from writers he admired, as with Elephant, which was partly the work of a man named Calmet. He didn't publish the completed work until 1755, however. He wanted to persuade Oxford University to grant him a degree, believing that if he was able to add it to his name on the title page, it would do Oxford, the book's sales, and himself, and not necessarily in that order, a lot of good. Oxford agreed, and on April the 15th, 1755, there appeared a dictionary of the English language in which the words are deduced from their originals and illustrated in their different significations by examples from the best writers, to which are prefixed a history of the language and an English grammar by Samuel Johnson, A.M., in 2 volumes. The book, which went into 4 editions during Johnson's lifetime, was to remain the standard work, an unrivalled repository of the English language for the next century. It was an enormous commercial success and was almost universally praised, particularly by the egregious Lord Chesterfield, who hinted that he had had rather more to do with the book's making than he had. This enraged Johnson. Not only did he mutter about whores and dancing masters, but he had up his sleeve the unkindest cut. Under the definition of patron, he had written, "A wretch who supports with indolence and is paid with flattery." But the noble lord brushed this aside too, as lords are wont to do. There were some critics. The fact that Johnson allowed his own personality to invade the pages may today seem pleasant whimsy, but to some who wanted the book to be supremely authoritative, it was irritatingly unprofessional. Many writers sniped at the limited authority of some of those whom Johnson quoted, a criticism that Johnson himself anticipated in his preface. Some found the definitions patchy, some of them trite, some unnecessarily complicated, as with the word network, anything reticulated or decussated at equal distances, with interstices between the intersections. A century after publication, the redoubtable Thomas Babington Macaulay was to damn Johnson as a wretched etymologist. But, Macaulay aside, many of the critics were probably just jealous, envious that Johnson had done what none of them could ever do. "Any schoolmaster might have done what Johnson did," wrote one. "His dictionary is merely a glossary to his own barbarous works." But the writer was anonymous, and quite probably a disappointed rival. Or else a rabid Whig. Johnson was a noted Tory, and wrote with what some thought a distinctive Tory bias. "So the book was merely a vehicle for Jacobite and high-flying tracts," wrote one Whig, doubtless a diehard. One woman even disparaged Johnson for failing to include obscenities. "No, madam, I hope I have not daubed my fingers," he replied archly. "I find, however, that you have been looking for them." Yet the accolades were many. Voltaire proposed that the French model a new dictionary of their own on Johnson's, and the venerable Accademia della Crusca wrote from Florence that Johnson's work will be a perpetual monument of fame to the author, an honour to his own country in particular, and a general benefit to the Republic of Letters throughout all Europe. "In an age of dictionaries of all kinds," wrote a modern consideration, "Johnson's contribution was simply primus inter pares." And Robert Birchfield, who edited the 4-volume supplement to the Oxford English Dictionary in the 1970s, had no doubts. Johnson managed to combine being both a lexicographer and a supremely literate man. "In the whole tradition of the English language and literature," he wrote, "the only dictionary compiled by a writer of the first rank is that of Dr. Johnson." Throughout it all, under the reins of slings, arrows, plaudits and encomiums, Samuel Johnson remained calmly modest. Not unduly so, for he was proud of his work, but awed by the magnificence of the language that he, with such foolhardiness, had chosen to tackle. The book remained his monument. James Murray was to say in later years that whenever someone used the phrase "the dictionary," as one might say "the Bible" or "the prayer book," he or she referred to the work by Dr. Johnson. But no, literature's great Cham would have said, in fact, it was the words that were the truest monument, and even more profoundly, the very entities that those words defined. "I am not yet so lost in lexicography," he says in his famous preface, "as to forget that words are the daughters of earth, and that things are the sons of heaven." His life had been devoted to the gathering in of those daughters, but it was heaven that had ordained their creation. The Big Dictionary Conceived. Elephant, noun. A huge quadruped of the pachydermate order, having long, curving ivory tusks and a prehensile trunk or proboscis. Of several species once distributed over the world, including Britain, only 2 now exist, the Indian and African. The former, the largest of extant land animals, is often used as a beast of burden and in war. The achievements of the great dictionary makers of England's 17th and 18th centuries were prodigious indeed. Their learning was unrivalled, their scholarship sheer genius, their contributions to literary history profound. All this is undeniable. And yet, cruel though it seems even to venture to inquire, who now really remembers their dictionaries, and who today makes use of all that they achieved? The question begs an inescapably poignant truth, of the kind that dims so many other pioneering achievements in fields that extend beyond and are quite unrelated to this one. The reality, as seen from today's perspective, is simply, however distinguished the lexicographical works of Thomas Eliot, Robert Cawdrey, Henry Cockerham, and Nathaniel Bailey, and however masterly and pivotal the creation of the great Cham, Samuel Johnson himself, their achievements seem nowadays to have been only stepping stones, and their magnificent volumes of work very little more than curios, to be traded, hoarded, and forgotten. And the reason for this is principally that in 1857, just over a century after the publication of the first edition of Johnson's Dictionary, there came a formal proposal for the making of a brand new work of truly stellar ambition, a lexicographical project that would be of far, far greater breadth and complexity than anything attempted before. It had as its goal a quite elegantly simple impertinence. While Johnson had presented a selection of the language, and an enormous selection at that, brilliantly fashioned, this new project would present all of it. Every word, every nuance, every shading of meaning and spelling and pronunciation, every twist of etymology, every possible illustrative citation from every English author. It was referred to simply as the Big Dictionary. When conceived, it was a project of almost unimaginable boldness and foolhardiness, requiring great bravura, risking great hubris. Yet there were men in Victorian England who were properly bold and foolhardy, who were more than up to the implicit risks. This was, after all, a time of great men, great vision, great achievement. Perhaps no time in modern history was more suited to the launching of a project of such grandiosity, which is perhaps why duly and ponderously it got underway. Grave problems and seemingly intractable crises threatened more than once to wreck it. Disputations and delays surrounded it, but eventually, by which time many of those great and complicated men who first had the vision were long in their graves, the goal of which Johnson himself might have dreamed was duly attained. And while Samuel Johnson and his team had taken 6 years to create their triumph, those involved in making what was to be and still is the ultimate English dictionary took 70 years, almost to the day. The Big Dictionary's making began with the speech at the London Library on Guy Fawkes Day, 1857. Richard Chenevix Trench was officially designated by his contemporary obiturists as a divine, a term that's rarely used today, but that embraced all manner of good and eminent Victorians who pursued all kinds of callings and who wore the cloth while doing so. At the time of his death, in 1886, Trench was still regarded more as a divine than anything else. He had had a glittering ecclesiastical career that culminated in his being made Dean of Westminster and then Archbishop of Dublin. He was also lame because of breaking both his knees, not because of any excess of genuflective piety, however, but because he fell down a gangplank while crossing on the boat to Ireland. His theme on that lexicographically famous evening was intriguing. Advertised on handbills and in flyers posted around London's West End, it was "On Some Deficiencies in Our English Dictionaries." By today's standards, the title seems self-effacing, but given the imperial temper of the time, and the firm belief that English was the quintessential imperial language, and that any books that dealt with it were important tools for the maintenance of the empire, the title offered an amply understandable hint of the impact that Dr. Trench would be likely to have. He identified 7 principal ways in which the dictionaries then available were found to be wanting. Most of them are technical and shouldn't concern us here. But his underlying theme was profoundly simple. It was an essential credo for any future dictionary maker, he said, to realize that a dictionary was simply an inventory of the language, and decidedly not a guide to proper usage. Its assembler had no business selecting words for inclusion on the basis of whether they were good or bad. Yet all of the craft's earlier practitioners, Samuel Johnson included, had been guilty of doing just that. The lexicographer, Trench pointed out, was an historian, not a critic. it was not within the remit of one dictator, or 40, he added with a cheeky nod at Paris, to determine which words should be used and which should not. A dictionary should be a record of all words that enjoy any recognised lifespan in the standard language. At the heart of such a dictionary, he went on, should be the history of the lifespan of each and every word. Some words are ancient and exist still. Others are new and vanish like mayflies. Still others emerge in one lifetime, continue to exist through the next, and look set to endure forever. Others deserve a less optimistic prognosis. Yet all these types of words are valid parts of the English language, no matter that they're old and obsolete, or new and with questionable futures. Consider the golden question, said Trench. If someone needs to look up any word, then it should be there. For if not, the work of reference that the book purports to be becomes a nonsense, something to which one cannot refer. Now he was warming to his theme. To chart the life of each word, he continued, to offer its biography, as it were, it's important to know just when the word was born, to have a record of the register of its birth. Not in the sense of when it was first spoken, of course, that, until the advent of the tape recorder, could never be known, but when it was first written down. Any dictionary that was to be based on the historical principles that Trench insisted were the only truly valid ones had to have, for every word, a passage quoted from literature that showed where each word was used first. And after that, and also for each word, there should be sentences that show the twists and turns of meanings, the way almost every word slips in its silvery, fish-like way, weaving this way and that, adding subtleties of nuance to itself, and then perhaps shedding them, as the public mood dictates. A dictionary, Trench said, is an historical monument, the history of a nation contemplated from one point of view, and the wrong ways into which a language has wandered may be nearly as instructive as the right ones. Johnson's dictionary may have been among the pioneers in presenting quotations, when Italian, for example, claimed that his dictionary had already done so in 1598, but they were there only to illustrate meaning. The new venture that Trench seemed now to be proposing would demonstrate not merely meaning, but the history of meaning, the life story of each word. And that would mean the reading of everything and the quoting of everything that showed anything of the history of the words that were to be cited. The task would be gigantic, monumental, and according to the conventional thinking of the times, impossible. Except that here Trench presented an idea to those ranks of conservative and frock-coated men who sat silently in the library on that dank and foggy evening, was potentially dangerous and revolutionary, but it was the idea that in the end made the whole venture possible. The undertaking of the scheme, Trench said, was beyond the ability of any one man. To peruse all of English literature, and to comb the London and New York newspapers and the most literate of the magazines and journals, must be instead the combined action of many. It would be necessary to recruit a team, moreover a huge one, probably comprising hundreds and hundreds of unpaid amateurs, all of them working as volunteers. The audience murmured with surprise. Such an idea, obvious though it may sound today, had never been put forward before. But then, some members said as the meeting was breaking up, it did have some real merit. It had a rough, rather democratic appeal. It was an idea consonant with Trench's underlying thought that any grand new dictionary ought to be itself a democratic product, a book that demonstrated the primacy of individual freedoms, of the notion that one could use words freely, as one liked, without hard and fast rules of lexical conduct. Any such dictionary certainly should not be an absolutist, autocratic product, such as the French had in mind. The English, who had raised eccentricity and poor organisation to a high art, and who had placed the scatterbrain on a pedestal, loathed such Middle European things as rules, conventions, and dictatorships. They abhorred the idea of diktats, about the language, for heaven's sake, emanating from some secretive body of uncountable immortals. Yes, nodded a number of members of the Philological Society, as they gathered up their astrakhan-collared coats and white silk scarves and top hats that night, and strolled out into the yellowish November fog. Dean Trench's notion of calling for volunteers was a good one, a worthy and really rather noble idea. And it was also, as it happens, an idea that would eventually permit the involvement in the project of one scholarly but troubled lexicographer, Monquet, assistant surgeon retired, U.S. Army, Brevet Captain William Chester Minor.